In the last episode, we took a look at the state of affairs for the caregivers of those with college ambitions. We now turn our attention back to the applicants themselves, and specifically those of a particular faith. I'll be joined today by Hamza Henshaw of Five Before College, who also turns out to be an old friend. Hamza was born and raised in Boston and accepted Islam in 1994 while attending St. Mark's, a suburban boarding school in Southborough, Massachusetts. In 2001, he graduated from Harvard College, where he concentrated in Near Eastern languages and civilizations with a minor in economics. He began his career in the field of Islamic finance, working for Rockefeller in New York and Saudi Arabia. In 2003, he transitioned to the field of education and taught at Al Noor Academy and was Dean of Students, overseeing the dual enrollment program and serving as the college and guidance counselor for the high school. During COVID, when everything shut down and the whole world turned online, he began to share his experiences online and helped thousands of students in various parts of the world with diverse backgrounds. That became a stepping stone for his current initiative, Five Before College. Hamza, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here as well.
So, could you explain your background and specifically what got you into teaching career, just to let our listeners know, too, we were friends as kids a long time ago when I saw you a lot in Maine, in Blue Hill, Maine. But yeah, curious about your path into teaching.
Yeah, thank you so much. And it's great to connect with you. And it's interesting how our paths have sort of diverged. We did spend a lot of time up in Maine as teenagers and so on. And then we sort of went our separate ways. But now we're in, you know, somewhat parallel worlds and education. So yeah. So my sort of story, I'll try to be as brief as I can. I was born and raised in Boston and grew up in that area. Eventually, for high school, I went off to private school, St. Mark's, which is in Southborough, boarding school. My father went there. My grandfather went there. It was a big Henshaw family tradition of going to St. Mark's. And something a bit unexpected happened when I went there, where I met a classmate who was Muslim. And it's a long story. And if you'd like, we can go into more details. But ultimately, myself and two other people ended up becoming Muslim, embracing Islam at that point. And obviously, that's not the typical outcome of St. Mark's, but it definitely changed the trajectory of my life. And so from St. Mark's, you know, when I went through the whole, you know, college application process, you know, fortunately, I'd always been a, you know, pretty strong student and so on. Both Nabil and I ended up getting into Harvard, and we both chose to delay for a year. So we took a year off, and that was a really magical time in my life. I essentially spent about 10 months on the road. I got this around the world ticket where you could have unlimited number of stops as long as you always flew in the same direction. So I flew from Boston to San Francisco to Hawaii, because it's there, to Thailand. And then I spent 3 months in Nepal, living with homestay family, trekking in the Himalayas, doing all sorts of stuff, India. And then, you know, the rest of the trip was really all around Europe, backpacking. I did an art history program. It was a really amazing, amazing year.
No Mecca?
Not at that point, no. The first time I went there was right after I finished college.
Does that count as the Hajj? Or?
So there's two different pilgrimages. There's sort of the smaller pilgrimage, which is called Umrah, and that can be done at any time throughout the year. Whereas the Hajj is time-bound.
Oh, I see.
During a particular month. It just happened a few weeks ago, actually. And so I did do that as well in 2003 or so. But, you know, typically when you go there, even just this last Ramadan in March, we were living over in Turkey and we went for Umrah. We went for that smaller pilgrimage just a few months back. So that's something you can do at any time. So I've probably been, I don't know, 4 or 5 times for that. And I do the Hajj once as well. But yeah, so to get into the education whole world, so after arriving at Harvard, learning Arabic was a real priority for me. I didn't even know the alphabet when I arrived. So that was something I knew I wanted to study. And I sort of saw myself as someone who, you know, could be equally comfortable in like a Western boardroom as sort of on the floor of a mosque in the Muslim world, right? Like, you know, someone who had that sort of cultural chameleon type thing where you can adapt to your circumstances and be very comfortable and be a bridge figure between these cultures, which sometimes are, you know, seemingly at odds with each other. And that was sort of like the big picture. My specific idea as I graduated and so on was to get involved in Sharia compliant investing. So in Islam, interest is problematic and forbidden. And so there's a whole Islamic banking sector that has different mechanisms by which they do financing and things like that. But that also carries over to the whole world of investing, that you want to invest in companies that are fine in terms of what they do in tobacco or alcohol, but then also in terms of how they're financed. So if they're highly leveraged, if they've taken out a lot of debt financing, then they become not permissible to invest in themselves. Mm-hmm. So in any case, in the States at that point, there was no real easy way to invest in this way. And I saw a big opportunity there. So I thought, why don't I go and, you know, learn about this world? So I ended up working in Rockefeller Asset Management on an Islamic account, working a little bit in Saudi and then down in South Africa as well. So I had this, you know, initial exposure to Islamic finance, Islamic investing, corporate world. But within, you know, a couple of years, I realized that this made sense on paper, but it wasn't lighting me up. It wasn't something I enjoyed. And that's when I made a big pivot. And that's when I got into education. Soul searching. And I was like, this stuff doesn't light me up. This isn't me. And so then I switched over to education. And the very first job I ever had was a maternity leave position in Sharon, Massachusetts at the Islamic Academy of New England. You know, I was, I don't know, 23, 24 years old or something like that. And then I got a job over in the Emirates teaching fifth grade at an international school over there.
Oh, wow. I didn't know you were over there. Yeah.
The interesting thing there was I was hired as a high school history teacher. And then when I arrived, they're like, actually, you're going to be the fifth grade homeroom teacher. And so suddenly I had to teach all these subjects. You know, I was always more of a humanities person. So I assumed, and this turned out to be false, that teaching English and history would be relatively easy for me, but then teaching math and science would be hard. But it was quite the opposite because, you know, these were all
very structured
letters and things.
Mm.
The math was very clear and so on, whereas teaching English proved to be challenging. So I decided to get my master's in TESOL, teaching English to speakers of other languages. I love travel. Like I mentioned that around the world, but I've probably been to, you know, 45, 50 countries in the course of my life. And so I thought, hey, if I have this degree, I can teach at the university level. I can teach at school. I can live anywhere I ever want in the world and teach and do well. So that was sort of my thought process. I spent a year in Cairo working on my Arabic. I did a fellowship from the US government and really got more fluent in Arabic. Eventually did come to Brattleboro, Vermont, the School for International Training, which was one of the top TESOL programs. And then my first real teaching job in the States was at a private school. It's called the Faye School. It's right across from St. Mark's. So, you know, Faye's top tier private boarding school, junior boarding school. So it only goes through ninth grade. And, you know, it was good to be in, you know, a school that obviously knew what it was doing. It's been around for a very long time. Obviously, it's also catering to a particular population catering. You know, I was working with international students there. I was teaching ESL. And these were like the one percenters of the one percenters, right? Like these were Prini students, other ones from, you know, very, very successful, well-known families who were spending 75 grand a year or more to send their kids off to boarding school when they were in middle school, right? And it was sort of the first stop on the gravy train of, you know, going off to pre-colleges. It was fantastic. Those kids were amazing. I stay in touch with a lot of them. But ultimately, I started to feel that, you know, these kids are probably going to be in pretty good shape with my help or without it, right? You know, they got a lot going for them. And, you know, I really wanted to work with the community that I cared deeply about, which was the sort of Muslim American community. After 7 years at Faye, I decided to make a big move over to Al Noor Academy, which is New England's first K-12 Islamic school. And my vision was to bring a lot of the best practices I'd learned at Faye and other places and you know, try to upgrade the Islamic school experience. And so I did all sorts of things there. I was the head of the humanities department. I taught 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade English. So usually only 3 sections a year, but I taught all those. I was the assistant head of school, so had a lot of administrative duties. And then, you know, I was also the sort of dual enrollment coordinator and the college guidance counselor. So yeah, you know, these small schools, you end up wearing a lot of hats.
Yeah, that's the term they use. Also known as budget crunch.
Exactly. And so you just sort of fill in everything. And so it was in the college placement area where I felt like as having the biggest impact on the students. You know, as someone who, you know, obviously gone to private school, had done well myself with the college process, understood the mentality and how it works, writing was always sort of a superpower of mine. You know, we had a lot of success. The very first student I ever had to place at Elnora got in early to Harvard. And then, you know, consistently year after year, at least the kids at the top of the class were going off to, you know, Ivies and other top 20 schools and things like that. And it was just really gratifying. You know, the Elnora tuition, I think when I got there, was something like $8,000 a year. Faye was, you know, like I said, $75,000. So like, you know, like this huge gap. Yet the results that they were getting were, you know, much better than you're getting at the local public school. And they were on par with what would happen at any top private school, despite having such limited resources. And so, you know, I did that for many years, about 12 years I was there. And obviously I had my own family and it was a great lifestyle and so on. But ultimately during the pandemic, we had this year, actually year and a half, 2 years, where I suddenly didn't have to go into the classroom. I didn't have to, you know, lunch duty and classroom and all the stuff that I didn't love getting to teach online. And I realized, hey, you know, life could be different. Like, you know, there are different ways that you can structure your life. Cause I think you get like sort of pigeonholed when you're a teacher. Like I've sort of reached the pinnacle of what I could accomplish by staying within that ecosystem. You know, and I looked at some head of school positions, actually got some head of school offers at different Islamic schools around the country and things. And I gamed it out in my head, and I was like, I'm not sure that that's really what I want to be doing. And I think for me, as I look back on my story, you know, I became Muslim at the age of 15, and when I look at it, a lot of my life has been devoted to working with that same age group and helping them have similar epiphanies. I just think like there's this magic of that age. When they're younger than that, they're sort of parroting what their parents say, and when they get a little older, they think they know everything, sort of shut down. But there's this small little window right around 15, 16, where they're trying to figure out who they are, their place in the world. And when you provide really strong guidance during that time, it can be transformative. And so, you know, as I was trying to imagine, you know, okay, so the biggest impact I'm having is in college counseling for Muslims. Why don't I bring these skills to, you know, the Muslim community as a whole? But then, you know, obviously that's just an idea. And then in practice, how does it work? So over time, the idea developed. And one of the things I realized, the secret sauce for our success at Elnora was that I wasn't just the college counselor. The very thing which you could point to as a weakness, like the fact that you're wear 17 hats.
Right.
Were the strength, because I used to teach these kids in sixth grade. I teach them in ninth and 10th grade. I was their dual enrollment coordinator. I knew everything about these kids by the time I was helping them with the college. The ability to guide them was remarkable. And a lot of college consulting becomes a little bit more transactional. It's based on, you know, this really important process of applying.
Yeah.
And filling in
application. It is results driven, right? Yeah.
but what we had done was more relationship driven, you know, so I wanted to create that same, it's, you know, for me, getting into a top college is sort of like, you know, a great outcome. It's almost like a happy byproduct of having an extraordinary. And using high school to find out who you are and discover your deeper purpose and come up with a bigger vision for your life. And those are the things that really light me up. Those are the conversations that I really enjoy. So it's, you know, obviously, you know, after all this time, I'm a real expert in helping positioning and personal branding and, you know, the essays and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, it's the deeper work that happens before then. And so that's why, you know, when I had to come up with a company name, we ended up calling it Five Before College. So Five Before College is this, you know, it sort of has two parts to the name. One is that the best time to prepare for college is not, you know, one before college, two before college, like your junior, senior year. It's five before college, way back at the end of middle school.
Oh, I was wondering about that. Okay. All right.
Eighth, ninth grade is, you know, the time when if you start making strategic decisions and start planning with the end in mind and so on at that point, you can have a much bigger impact. And so like the ideal customer journey for us is a student comes to us in eighth grade or ninth grade. We have a program called Find Your Qibla, which is like an 8-week immersion program to help them find their purpose, launch a passion project. And then they continue with us. We have an ongoing program called Find Your Qibla Squared, which is sort of like a 12-month program. But ideally, they join us in 8th or 9th grade. They stick with us all the way through the college application process so that we're able to provide, you know, not just college counseling, but life coaching and that sort of thing all along the way. And then the second part of Five Before College is it's based on a hadith or a saying of the Prophet, peace be upon him, who said that take advantage of five before five. Your old age, your health before sickness, your wealth before poverty, your free time before busyness, and your life before death. Right? So this is a
interesting
saying that always stuck out to me. In fact, before I had Five Before College, I have a Substack called Five Before Five. I've always loved this framing and so on. And what I realized is, you know, in terms of like holistic college admissions, it's not just about academics. I think one of the things is a lot of immigrant families think if you have good grades and you have good SAT scores, then you're golden. Like you're going to get into all these top 20 schools. And the reality, as you know, and as we'll know, is that, you know, grades and test scores are necessary, but not sufficient. Right. And it's ultimately all the other stuff. And so that five before five hadith is an incredible architecture container to think about how do you spend those 5 years before college. And that's really what our company tries to do is, you know, help kids excel in all of those different areas, whether, you know, through athletics and health and, you know, mental health, through exploring careers and wealth and understanding money and that kind of thing, through their extracurriculars, through their friendships, and then, of course, through their character and their faith and how that shows up. So, sorry, that was a very long...
I love what you said. This is the short version of me.
Yeah, that was the short version.
I mean, I suppose you are telling your life history. So you are telling a history of 25 yeah. years. And you're a former history teacher. So I sort of asked for it there, didn't I? Here are some things that stood out to me after the first segment of my conversation with Hamza. You can immediately tell that Hamza is somebody who is passionate about what he's doing and actually invested and engaged, willing to push himself, learn more, genuinely engage with his profession. I've interviewed a lot of educational consultants on the show, and you can very quickly parse out the difference between those who are just kind of going through the motions and checking the boxes for kids, you know, who are trying to get into Ivy League schools, and those who have some actual personal investment in what they're doing and in the kids that they're serving. And he definitely sticks out on the upper end of the spectrum in terms of personal involvement. Another thing that stuck out to me was his five before college mission, which, as he mentioned, kind of has a double entendre with the Islamic principles of life before death, for instance, those five categories that he mentioned, but also beginning in eighth grade. So 5 years before college experience, you know, founded in his experience as somebody who wore a lot of hats, quote unquote. That's an old adage from private schools who are struggling to fit into a budget. But as he mentioned, you get to know the students on a lot of different levels. This will sound familiar to anyone who's been in a boarding school, for instance, or even a small private school. Such an intimate relationship becomes really the foundation of the college placement process. I find that very interesting and a great combination, I'd say, with the Islamic principles that he mentioned in terms of maybe placing the cart before the horse. Hopefully, they've got that metaphor arranged properly. You know, actually having some sort of sincere connection to where you're sending this child or where they elect to send themselves. That can be a fairly impersonal process in a lot of cases. So making that into something that's really part of a Bill Dungsroman, if you will, a coming of age, a finding of self, requires a more extensive relationship. If you're just meeting them senior year and they're a number and a statistic, that process is, I would argue, not going to be nearly as fulfilling. And that doesn't necessarily just refer to where they end up going to school, how competitive that school is, where it ranks on the rankings, but really the whole reverberation of that entire process on their lives. That is really going to be a far different experience if you start in eighth grade. What are, I mean, simply put, the distinctions in working with Islamic students in your consulting?
I think, you know, for one thing, by making this choice of being sort of a faith-forward, faith-facing brand, it made building an audience much easier. I think, you know, obviously there's tons of college counselors out there. But one thing that didn't seem to exist was, you know, there were some other Muslim college counselors, but there's no religious component to anything that they were doing. Whereas by choosing that niche, and a niche that I cared a lot about, and that I, you know, I always say I speak Muslim fluently, right? Like, there's a way that you can communicate with that population. And it's something that I care deeply about. I think fundamentally within the Islamic tradition, I'd say within all the Judeo-Christian traditions, but I think it's maybe, you know, emphasized even more within Islam, is that there's the idea that there's this world, which we call the dunya, the world of this life. And then there's the next life, right? Which is, I mean, again, I grew up a Christian and so on. So they talk about heaven and hell and things like that. And, you know, it's largely the same. We call it the akhirah, the afterlife, right? So fundamentally, if you read the Quran or you as you learn more about the faith, so much of it is about trying to emphasize that the real success comes in being successful in the next life, right? That, and that's the way that everything sort of evens out, right? There's a lot of things here in this world that aren't fair. Some people are born to lives of extreme privilege. Some people are born to extremely difficult lives and so on. But everyone is sort of equal and doing everything they can with the cards that have been dealt to them to lead a meaningful life, to work on their faith and work on their good deeds and things like that. And ultimately it all gets sort of evened out on this day of judgment and so on. So a lot of, like, find your qibla, which is our core programming. The qibla is actually the direction that you pray towards Mecca. You know, so when we pray five times a day, you know, the direction of the prayer is towards Mecca. So wherever you are in the world, some people say, oh, Muslims pray to the east. You know, if you're west of Mecca, then you pray to the west, right? So the qibla is that direction. So in practice, we have apps on our phone where, you know, I'm in the woods or I'm, you know, at a gas station or whatever, I have to pray, like, the compass built into the phone that tells you which direction to pray.
It's helpful. And,
like, we all need a compass. We need a North Star within our life. So the idea of Find Your Qibla is, you know, first and foremost, to help Muslim kids have Islam be their North Star. And many of the kids who come to us, sort of already the case, like, they already are coming from practicing Muslim families that might not even know that this college consulting industry exists, but they're really attracted to the fact that we're talking in those terms. And then other families come to us because, you know, they see that their children are struggling with their faith. And as someone who became Muslim and had a lot of ups and downs in my own adoption of the faith and things like that, you know, I feel like I can speak to both groups pretty well. But the idea is, you know, to first and foremost install that akhirah, that afterlife mindset. The whole purpose of our lives here is to lead a life of purpose and meaning that we're sort of proud to present.
I see.
You know, so that frames the whole relationship of what we're trying to do. But then, you know, the other idea that we merge is, you know, that you want to have some sort of a North Star within this life as well. Like, most of the most successful people, if you look at their stories, you listen to their podcasts or biographies, something usually happened right around that age of 15, 16. Some idea got planted in their mind of what they can do. There's a great book called The Magic of Thinking Big. You know, it's all about this, like, this idea that if you dream about what you can accomplish with no limits, then, you know, the how sort of reveals itself. You have to figure out why, and then really, you know, just have this clear conviction that you're going to eventually, you know, found this big tech company, or you're going to do, you know, whatever it is that you want to accomplish.
It's a byproduct. Right. In fact,
these days, like, kids aren't, school doesn't ask them to do that. They never, you know, you get so stuck in just the day to day APs and doing, you know, checking off all the boxes. And, you know, there are all these, like, professional students who have no idea why it all matters. And then when they go through the college process, they look at U.S. News and World Report and they're like, okay, I want to go to these schools because they're supposedly the best. And it's like, what's the purpose? Right. So I try to reframe the college process. College is not a trophy. Rather, it's a trophy. So college is not this glittery thing that we get for our ego and so we can brag for, you know, right, to everyone. Instead, it's...
Which is a tendency. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
That is the
tendency. Yeah.
There's definitely a tension there because, like, I use my Harvard pedigree all the time and, there's definitely a tension, like, there.
But, well, and you've sent kids to very good schools, too.
Yeah. And the reality is, like, you sell them what they want, give them what they need, right? Like, so, and I'm not saying this because I'm sure, hopefully we have some future customers on this. It's not like a beat and switch. Like, we genuinely can and have and do help kids get into these top schools, but it doesn't really matter where you go to school if you don't have any vision for your life. And there's this other book, Robert Kiyosaki, who wrote Rich Dad Poor Dad. He also wrote another book called Why A Students End Up Working for C Students, right? So why A students end up working for C students is really
right. Interesting. You know,
people who are really exceptionally talented in the fairly artificial environment of school don't always kill it in the real world.
Mm.
And a lot of times it is those misfits. It is those kids who the school just feels like, wow, what are these stupid rules? And like, honestly, they're probably more onto something than you know, the kids who love to just play by the rules. And then when they reach the real world, and suddenly the stakes are much clearer and things like that, then they're able to go off and kill it and do really well.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I'm not preaching that everyone should be a C student. It's more like you can be an A student who also has this growth mindset and this ability to overcome challenges.
Sure.
And so on.
A high degree, a pedigree like that certainly opens up some channels for ambition. It's not a small deal, but you know, just because it's not everything doesn't mean it's not something. I think there is a line to walk there.
Yeah. So I think, you know, in our programming, you know, you teach who you are, right? So I'm using poetry, I'm using Shakespeare, I'm using, you know, all my English background.
Nice.
But then I'm also using Quranic verses, I'm using Hadith of the Prophet, things like that, as we're trying to give them that guidance. You know, Islam definitely underpins everything. We certainly are open to working with anyone, but the reality is our marketing and everything are very Muslim focused. So the vast majority of the people in our ecosystem are Muslim. I do want us to reach a stage where it's just such high quality programming that it's sort of like a Catholic school that a lot of kids who are not Catholic end up going there. You know, so I think that may come down the line. But for now, the need within the Muslim community itself is tremendous and getting a lot of traction. And, you know, we've only been in business since the start of 2023, but we've already built a team of 6 and the business is growing revenue wise and so on month after month and everything. So it's, you know, it's been pretty encouraging to see this idea is something that is resonating with the audience.
Five Before College, it helps Islamic students pursue higher education while remaining true to their faith. That was a line that stuck out to me on your website. I'm just wondering, what are the risks, if there are any, in that college process for those of the Islamic faith? You know, are there things to avoid there? Are there contrasts in terms of value?
You know, I think, you know, within Islam, as is true of, you know, classical Judaism or even Christianity, there are, you know, certain things like, so obviously it's well known that alcohol is not permissible within Islam. A lot of social things that happen in college are alcohol based. It's pretty easy. You know, if you're in that setting, there's a lot of pressure to get involved with that.
While you're on that topic, so how do you kind of deal with that from a college consulting perspective? Are there schools that are maybe notorious for the influence of alcohol, for the pervasiveness of it, for the party culture that you avoid? Or how do you deal with that?
I mean, you definitely want to get kids to have an understanding. So if it's a school that is built around a sort of fraternity culture, or, you know, it's a party school, so to speak, you know, you want to go in eyes wide open. But I think more than anything, it's more about, like, it's easy to profess our faith on our tongue, but it's hard to, like, translate that into our heart. And, you know, the other thing I would say is, like, you know, kids are kids and they have ups and downs, and, you know, faith can sometimes wax and wane. And I think, you know, the reality is for a lot of Muslim students, it is difficult. It's difficult to be in that environment. You know, the other real challenge is in Islam, like, you know, there's no premarital type relations. That works in the context of marriage.
Right. And
most undergrads are not thinking about marriage. But again, like, you know, when it comes to, you know, topics like that, I think sometimes real talk with the kids is important. Like, it's not haram, like, to be attracted to someone. It's part of the human experience. It's how we're all here, right? And I think a lot of ways that within the sort of Muslim or mosque culture, like, there are certain, like, taboo topics that people just don't talk about. So some of it is about, like, really, you know, talking to the kids about how these feelings that you're having are very natural and very real, and there's nothing wrong with it, but there is, you know, a way to pursue these things. And then you can also sketch out some of the problems, you know, you go the opposite direction and so on. But a lot of that stuff, like I said, we largely focus on the high school experience at this point. It's not so much like My long-term vision of what I'm trying to build is before college, 5 during college, 5 after college, right? Where we're providing support all along
the
age of puberty and adolescence, all the way up to when they're really established in their careers, they're getting married, and to provide guidance, because it's not like once the kids get into college, then everything's all solved, right?
Definitely not, given the dropout rates.
And then early career is like the most challenging of all, I'd say. So that's really my real vision. It's sort of a mission to help Muslim teenagers, Muslim youth, really embrace their Islamic identity while also pursuing excellence in their worldly lives, in their professional lives, and for guidance all along the way.
It sounds like what you're proposing really is to provide actual counseling. College counseling, that's a common term to refer to them, but I didn't get any counseling from my college counselor. They're worried about the lists, and the test scores and the essays, all the practical matters, but none of the cultural ones, none of the personal ones, and how those interrelate with those sort of tangible details. So is that kind of like what you're envisioning?
Exactly. And I think the college process is that rite of passage. I think you described it as that before. Like, it's hard to get kids to think big about their future and so on. But if anything, like, is a focusing force, it's this college application. It's like the first time that they're forced to like take a step away from themselves, look at themselves from that, bird's eye perspective. Who am I? What am I all about? Where am I going? Right. And it's this incredible opportunity for them to become the author of their own destiny rather than just being the kid who's just sort of like, I'm just a leaf being blown by the winds of.
Right.
Like, I can actually have a vision for what I'm trying to become. Mm-hmm, right. And then make decisions to get there. I think the term at schools is guidance counselor. Right. The way, public schools in particular with funding issues and so on, like one guidance counselor might have 300-400 students. Who are you supposed to give this level of instruction and feedback, when you have all sorts of other...
100%. 100%.
Why this field exists in general and fill a specific gap within working with Muslims themselves.
Here are some things that stuck out to me after the second segment of my conversation with Hamza. I really loved the compass sort of second life, that whole concept that they focus on there. And then he talked about it really in two respects. The first one was interesting. It has to do with the religious component of Islam and thinking about this life as sort of setting up as a model for where you end up, where your version of heaven. What is it that you want to be proud of at the end of your life? And wow, that's a really, they talk about backwards education all the time. Like, where do you want to end up? Like, what lesson do you want to actually teach a kid? And then work backwards from there. Well, that's really working backwards in your entire life, taking a 20,000 foot view of things. Fairly interesting way of going about the college process and very different from the granular which school did you get into approach. That is, I would say, probably more typical than not in the college consulting world. But having a sort of North Star, what do you want this full life to look like? And fitting that sort of piece of where I go to college into that whole vision for your life. That's a tough task for somebody who's 17, certainly to have that type of longer vision. But I think still a great exercise, even if maybe they can't see that with crystal vision, and who can? Our crystal balls are all a little hazy at times, especially at that age. But really interesting to at least ask that question, to ponder it together. Another thing that stuck out to me was about educating, really, kids of the Islamic faith in particular. What colleges are going to look like, what specific colleges are going to look like, too, in terms of alcohol and premarital relations, to put that in euphemistic terms. I think that based on what he described, he really acts as a true counselor for those kids in thinking about where they're going, what they're going to be confronted with as far as alcohol and sex, what is going to be challenged about their faith. And I think, again, previewing that, thinking about what some of those conflicts are going to be like, and it's never going to be with crystal vision. You never know what you're going to encounter when you get to that four-year school, as we all know, going through it before. But I think
any degree of education on what you're going to encounter and what the principles that you've been taught are going to be put up against when you get there. I think that can be extraordinarily helpful, especially put in the context of a specific knowledge of what that school or that institution looks like. They're not all the same. I think UConn on a Saturday night looks an awful lot different than a Brown or an MIT. Certainly there are some things that they all share in common, but cultural differences, structural differences, social differences, the makeups of the schools, the policies, you know, I think all really inform that culture that can be so different from school to school. So curious, you know, what your impressions are about how the landscape for Muslim students has evolved, you know, post-pandemic. And really, I guess who I would describe our era best now is sort of the era of AI. So I'm just curious what sort of contemporary trends you're noticing for Islamic students.
Yeah, you know, so I think there's general trends and then maybe things that are more connected to Muslim students. You know, so obviously in a general category, the testing landscape has been flipped upside down by the pandemic where, you know, all schools had to go test optional and, you know, and then eventually some of the schools have brought it back. A lot of others loved the increased number of applications and the concurrent like lower acceptance rates, which pushes them up the list. Obviously, affirmative action came along and got, you know, overturned. So that's had some impact on
you know. Could you talk about that? What's the influence been from an Islamic standpoint?
So Islam is not a race, of course, and you have Muslims of all different stripes and things like that. And in fact, like Arab Muslims, which is actually only about 20% of the global Muslim population, are considered white. Right. And eventually they did put like a drop down menu of Middle Eastern where they got thrown into that. So I don't think they were getting any big, you know, admissions bump, at least on a pure demographic.
Yeah. You're better off being like a Pacific Islander or something.
Yeah. It's so weird. Like the Native American Pacific Islander, like all the power to them. But like there's so many other ethnicities out there. So I think colleges really do value diversity. They value ethnic diversity, socioeconomic diversity and things, and religious diversity.
Despite what the government instructs them to do.
Well, yeah, so that's what I was going to say. So I'd say like pre-current administration, a big question that students come to me with is like, Islam is a huge part of my life. I've memorized the whole Quran, like maybe I've been going to an Islamic school or something like that. But you know, there are fears of Islamophobia. It's not, you know, they really do exist. And there is some bias, you know, against them. They're like, can I talk about this in my application? And my guidance historically has been absolutely. If you know, Islam is the central pillar of your identity, for you to have an authentic college application where you don't touch on it, that would be really problematic, you know, but there are, of course, ways to do it. You don't want to come across as dogmatic. You want to come across as someone who is, you know, willing to engage with a wide variety of perspectives on a college campus and so on. And so I put together this 5 Muslim college essays that worked of students that I worked with who have written essays where they do talk about their Islamic identity in one way or another in a really effective kind of way. And it's sort of like a, you know, one of the download lead magnet type things that we use frequently. So that was all pre-current administration. Now, I mean, honestly, it's a really, really tricky issue, you know, because obviously, what's happening now in the Middle East, you know, especially in Gaza and so on, is deeply impacting a lot of students. I have a lot of Palestinian students who have family members who have been killed, you know, and just generally, it's sort of an issue that many parts of the world have a different perspective on it than the dominant perspective we have here in the States. And now with the current administration, with, you know, branding all these schools as anti-Semitic, and like largely that's what they're going after Harvard for, the anti-Semitism, it's a complicated world. You know, one of their biggest accomplishments extracurriculars was that they were very involved in protests and things like that, world issue for them. And do they talk about that on their application? And in the past, my advice was like, do you really want to go to a school where if you talk about your identity in that way and it's like campus? Sometimes the colleges want you on campus, but they're afraid of what you might bring to the campus because, you know, if you protest or something, and this is, you know, I work mostly with American citizens. If you're not an American citizen, what's happening now is troubling and problematic.
So much for free speech, huh? I mean, free speech, as long as you get into the right college doing so.
Right. Yeah. You know, and I do have, you know, some international students and, you know, and certainly within my own network, you know, there are, you know, all sorts of people whose lives have been overturned up, you know.
Yeah.
Because of these policies. So there's not a simple pat answer. I don't know what to tell these students of how to navigate that. But I do think you need to tread carefully with a lot of wisdom where you do celebrate your identity and so on. So, you know, I think in terms of modern contemporary trends, what we're dealing with now, I'm actually speaking on a NACAC panel in October or September, I guess. And we have a representative from a Jewish school, a Christian school, myself for Muslim, and then the UPenn director of admissions.
So, oh, that's so cool.
We're going to be talking about that faith identity and how it shows up in college and things like that. So I think it will be, you know, it's definitely an interesting.
It changes so quickly too, to put the, you know, the geopolitics are evolving so fast that it must be tough to keep up with.
Yeah, exactly. But generally speaking, I think, you know, it's not like Muslim students are a monolith, but like many of the students go through this process of memorizing the entire Quran. They memorize 620 pages of Arabic text and so on. Like, it's a pretty remarkable achievement. And in my experience, those kids are also usually incredibly gifted students. They've just, that process trains their brain to do, you know, to be pretty strong academically and so on. And for them, you know, to not have that be one of their activities, for them not to maybe write a supplement, you know, where they talk about that process is somewhat troubling. This was a long time ago. He's actually a friend of mine. He memorized the whole Quran when he was in South Africa at a sort of madrasa down there. Meanwhile, he was reading Harry Potter. So his college essay, like, was essentially about Hogwarts and the madrasa.
Oh, that's actually cool.
and, you know, he grew up in California. He'd gone to a traditional public school in California. Then he went to this madrasa, and he sort of used Harry Potter as this medium to reflect on the pros and cons of the American system, of the madrasa system, and then sort of merge them together in his conception of what's best. And it was a really remarkable essay. It's in that five Muslim college essay. And he ended up getting into every school that he applied to. In fact, Yale wanted him so badly that the president of Mexico was visiting Yale, and Yale got him to make a few admissions calls. And so this guy gets a phone call from the president of Mexico saying, hey, you should really consider coming to Yale.
Here are some final thoughts after my conversation with Hamza. When we're talking about the principle that they focus on there, providing a sort of North Star, the second version of that was a North Star in particular for this life. You know, so often, as he mentioned, the college admission is a sort of an endpoint for kids. Like, they've been working so hard for however many years, 14, 15 years, you know, to get to that point, especially if they hit the target, it's like, got the dream school, like, here we go, like, let's celebrate this. You know, spring semester of senior year becomes this tour of like joy and just like an exclamation point on it's fine academic career. Well, it's not the end of the road. And I think career students oftentimes can struggle when they get to the world, the ones that have done so well. I'm like, all right, great, this is it. Like, this is my reward, this school, this grade, this diploma, when really it's important to keep a sort of larger vision in mind of life, of what you want to accomplish on a corporeal scale, not just in terms of, you know, what do I want to be proud of at the end, but where am I going? 5 to 10 years. Now, that's a tough ask for 17-year-olds, but a really important one for high-achieving students in particular, who have this sort of academic mentality perhaps and have sort of thrived within a system that's been provided for them without having to think of the why. What am I doing here? What is this all going to be about? So I think, again, it's something that you need to continually make those kids aware of as they're going through this process that can be very much superscribed inside of a specific mission.